My guest at this time is syndicated radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt. He's also a constitutional law professor at Chapman University, and he's out with a brand new book, The Brief Against Obama, The Rise, Fall, and Epic Fail of the Hope and Change Presidency. And Hugh, it's good to have you with us.
Greg, good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
You contend that this is not only a failed presidency, it's historically failed to the point where nothing matches it in modern times of being this bad. That's a pretty strong statement.
I think if one walks through, Greg, from FDR forward, the only president who comes close to being this awful is Jimmy Carter. And just objectively speaking, we find ourselves in a much deeper hole because of the massive amount of spending and the now abuse of the office of the presidency. Carter, for all of his many, many and manifest failures, never abused his Article II powers in the way that this president does. I got a column in the Washington Examiner. I need to reissue the book already because the chapter on the abuse of his power just got added to on Friday with the executive order on immigration.
Are you surprised at the reaction to this in terms of some folks maybe talking about taking it to court, others saying, well, he really should have gone to Congress through this, but there doesn't really seem to be the type of outrage that necessarily would lead to him either reconsidering or getting a groundswell of public opinion against this move as something extra constitutional? Are you surprised by that?
I'm not surprised because it takes a while for things to settle in. As with the HHS mandate on all the Catholic colleges and universities, the initial outrage was followed by a head fake by the president saying, oh, we'll fix it. He didn't fix it. And you saw on Friday the Catholic Healthcare Association and Sister Mary Obama's friend recanted. And I think, you know, it takes a couple of months for people to realize the consequences of extra constitutional action. Just like they've sort of forgotten all of his promises on Obamacare, his promise that if you liked your health care plan, you can keep it. If you liked your doctor, you can keep it. The speech he made at the AMA, all these different things, which I put into the brief against Obama. The first couple of days after he does them, people say, oh, okay, and they move on because he changes the subject in classic Alinskyite style almost every day. But then when you walk through the record, which is what I do in the brief against Obama, I just make sure I do it page by page, using his own words, then citing the record of facts, and whether it's the promises he made, the predictions he rendered, or all of the countless platitudes he issues, they just don't stand up when one puts them back into the memory machine and say, wait a minute, he said that, he promised that, he pontificated that way. So there'll be a delayed reaction, Greg, but it is coming.
And we're talking with Hugh Hewitt, a syndicated talk show host. He's author of the new book, The Brief Against Obama. And Hugh, as you put this together, obviously most of the issues you cover, you and I have talked about on a daily basis. Most people who follow politics closely remember it. But as you compiled it all together, was there anything in particular that struck you as being even more significant than at the time that it happened?
Yeah, the most egregious thing was the first meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu in the basement of the White House when he left him cooling his heels and said, I'm around if anything changes. He's been trying to walk that back for the last 6 months, but I don't believe Jewish American voters who went overwhelmingly with President Obama in 2008 election are going to forget that. They're not going to trust him. Our friend Michael Medved just got back from Israel, and you know, I think that that Israel is not going to trust him. As Don Rumsfeld said on my show last week, they're not trusting him, and that gets back and deepens its impact upon Jewish American voters in key states like Florida and Ohio and in Colorado. That's a demographic he cannot afford to lose. So as I wrote that chapter, there are 10 chapters on his domestic policy failures, 10 on his foreign policy failures, 5 on his leadership failures. But of all those 25, his failure vis-a-vis Israel is probably the most profound and the one that will most greatly impact a specific demographic upon which he depends. Now, there's a lot in the brief against Obama that, you know, 300 pages and dozens and dozens and dozens of footnotes per chapter, so I can't really go through the whole thing. But I'll tell you this, almost everyone who has read it walks away saying, I had forgotten that. And that was my point. I did not want them to forget that as we run up to November.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Netanyahu story and the president's treatment of him at that particular meeting. I think a lot of people, certainly the conventional wisdom, let's put it that way, has been that the president has had clearly a lot of challenges on the domestic front, but perhaps he's been surprisingly effective on the international front. He would point to, of course, that he responsibly ended the war in Iraq. He's responsibly winding down the war in Afghanistan. He's re-established relationships around the globe. You turn that completely around and point out why you think that his international performance has been just as bad, if not worse, than the domestic front. What are most folks missing when they try to perhaps paint him as a result of the Milan raid and others, that he's actually been effective on that front?
Well, to his credit, he pulled the trigger on the bin Laden raid, but at the same time, he issued a CYA memo, or his CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta, now the DOD sec, issued a CYA memo. Very significantly, Eric Holder wasn't in the room. They kept for themselves some deniability, but I think when people go back to 2009 and they remember how he stood by during the Green Revolution, which was the first revolution of the spring that then swept through Egypt and Libya and is now convulsing Syria, he did nothing when the world's greatest threat could have been tipped over. He did absolutely nothing. And the statements from that time, the appeals of the dissidents, the people being slaughtered in the streets of Tehran, will always follow him, much like the Rwandan genocide followed Bill Clinton. The great missed opportunity that a guy who's in over his head just simply didn't realize. He tried to talk the Islamist theocrats into a relationship with us, which in his own mind, his charisma could deliver. Of course, it didn't. Megalomania only goes so far. In this case, it doesn't get much beyond the gates of the White House.
And we're talking with Hugh Hewitt. Again, the book is The Brief Against Obama, The Rise, Fall, and Epic Fail of the Hope and Change Presidency. And Hugh, let's look at the hope and change aspect of that for a moment, because in addition to different policy positions and perhaps some Bush fatigue from 4 years ago, one of the things that people seemed to gravitate towards Obama over was his persona, his positive attitude, the idea that things would be different in Washington. Now, of course, the gridlock's just as bad, if not worse than ever. He's pointing the finger of blame at the Republicans. The Republicans say, especially in the House, we've passed three dozen bills here that would get the economy going that he won't touch. And so forth and so on. So how much will the fact that there's not this great surge of optimism perhaps this year be a factor in this campaign?
Well, he deflated his own tires, Greg. One of the techniques I use in The Brief Against Obama is to begin each chapter with specific quotes from the president. So, for example, chapter 23 and chapter 25 begin with three quotes he gave just last year from September through November. In September in Orlando, he said, "This is a great, great country that has gotten a little soft." Then in October in San Francisco, he said, "We have lost our ambition, our imagination, our willingness to do the things that built the Golden Gate Bridge and the Hoover Dam." And then in November in Hawaii, he said, "We've been a bit lazy over the last couple of decades." Well, that is not hope and change rhetoric. That is the rhetoric of defeatism. And in fact, I quote one Great Britain columnist who writes for the Telegraph, saying he's the decline and despair president, not the hope and change president. So I think not only did he not deliver on the hope and the change, but the gulf between what he had promised and what he has delivered is so vast that we're seeing he is creating, as Ronald Reagan did in 1980, a new category of Democrats. He's creating Romney Democrats. He creates them every week. Every time he speaks, he creates more Romney Democrats, of people who say, "We tried this once before," and they're remembering. They're kind of remembering Jimmy Carter if they go back that far, if they are 32 years of a voting age, or maybe they were even 10 at the time and they're 42 now, and they're realizing this is just what happened in 1980. We went off of a cliff with a guy who ran on a wonderfully lofty rhetoric in a period of national stress. Then it was Watergate and the pardon. Now it's the financial panic of 2008. But it catches up with you, and voters are smart. They're not stupid. And I don't know if you saw David Plouffe, the president's point man, on yesterday with Chris Wallace, but the whole interview was an attempt to divert from the president's well-documented record, which I do again and again in The Brief Against Obama. And if they can't change the subject from that record, not only will he lose, he will lose significantly.
Hugh, but very quickly, historically speaking, American voters are somewhat reluctant to fire their president. We still see that his likability ratings are much higher than his job approval ratings. So what's the last thing that you would say to voters who are reluctant to get rid of this president, even though they aren't necessarily impressed with his record?
It's 1980 all over again, and if people want to get out of the hole, they have to embrace growth. They have to embrace a fresh start. I have in my law school office a portrait of Ronald Reagan from the Tuesday after the election on Time magazine, and it says a fresh start. We were deep in the ditch in November of 1980. We had turned it around in 4 years and had entered on an unprecedented era of growth, optimism, and strength. And last week I broadcast from the Reagan Ranch, the place where the great communicator gave more than 40 radio addresses. It's a beautiful place, by the way, Greg. If you ever get out there, ask the Young Americas Foundation to take you up. Very remote, very hard to get to. But we went from Solzhenitsyn declaring that we had lost to the Soviet Union in 1978 to Ronald Reagan 25 years ago last week saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. We can do it again, but people have to let go of the security blanket of believing that he's a nice guy. He is a nice guy. I love it when he's out with his daughters. Yesterday, there's a great picture of him with his daughters coming down the plane, and he's a fine husband and a fine dad. He's just a god-awful president, and so in retirement, he will do a lot of good things. But boy, that retirement had better come in January of 2013.
Well, we'll find out. If Hugh has any sway with the book, that could definitely happen. Hugh, thank you very much with your time today. We appreciate it very much.
Greg, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Nationally syndicated radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt. He's also a constitutional law professor at Chapman University. And the new book is The Brief Against Obama, The Rise, Fall, and Epic Fail of the Hope and Change Presidency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.